they've reset the criteria. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, I believe the distance is 30 miles now. Any lightning strike within 30 miles, they'll fly the next day.
Okay, so there's a good example of putting up a well-grounded structure adjacent to the antenna. Well, in the case of a launch of a space shuttle or some or a Apollo spacecraft, money is no object. You want to make sure that it's thoroughly protected. So therefore, you're willing to go through the heroics of putting an adjacent tower. Very few hams do that. And in my case, I don't have that. I've got this 100-foot structure sitting on top of 300-foot land in Huntington. Been here since 1969. It makes it, 45 or so years. And of all the lightning strikes I've suffered, they didn't come through my tower. They came through the 110-volt power line. I think it's George, W2 Alpha Kilo Echo, if I got it right there, George. Go right ahead with your information. AKE, K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Yeah, Dick. RIW, W2AKE. Listening on the lightning protection, I could give you one example. We deal with it constantly in our business. I just returned from Greece in a house we have there on a mountainside in Greece. At about 3,000 feet elevation, we had to build an infrastructure of consisting of angle iron, galvanized angle iron that was welded and bolted, and extending. We mounted all our satellite dishes. We also have internet via satellite and all our communication antennas all on that array. It's a pretty big array, about 10 foot by 10 foot. And extending from that, we used copper strapping, not copper wire, but strapping, flat ribbon strapping, extending to ground rod in like an arc around the actual frame. So, and that extended about 4 to 6 feet away from the frame. These positions were driven down. And then thereafter, we drove one ground rod in a proximity to the others and attached a megometer between that and the bonding of all the grounds and measured the actual conductivity to ground of our system and found it to be good. And with that, in this place is really susceptible to lightning strikes where it's positioned. You let it drop. So therefore, we had to take particular care, don't you want to have everything blown up. And also the issue of power. We have power supplies that trip out, were tripping out, up until we inserted a very simple device called the UPS. And the UPS suffices to protect our surges, our currents, problems, whatever may come about that would affect our power supplies, particularly on our satellite internet power supply. So with those precautions, we've pretty much remedied everything. I'm not saying that everything is foolproof because lightning is unpredictable, but for the most part, we have no strikes that are affecting us.
Glad to hear that, George. And I'm going to make a guess and see if I'm correct here. The 3,000-foot mountain in Greece, many mountains that are that kind of altitude have a whole lot of granite in them. And granite is a kind of rock with very low conductivity, nowhere near the conductivity of normal soil. And I know that Tom Williams, WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, a guy who lives in Shrewsbury, Massachusetts, I think it is, on top of a mountain, carefully chose a good ham location for VHF-UHF operation on top of a granite mountain, and he has very similar problems. So that when you're on a structure like a granite mountain with low conductivity, you got to sink a whole lot of grounding rods. You got to make a whole mat, so to speak, of horizontal and vertical straps, wires, and so on. You have to literally make all of your soil look like it's one great conductive sheet. Yes, there's a whole lot of gaps in between. It's not really a continuous sheet of conducting material, but you're going to come close to that in order to protect yourself from lightning. So a couple of guesses on my part. Was I correct in assuming that a lot of granite in that mountain, relatively low conductivity soil of your property in Greece, and that's why you had to do some of that? But you had the bad combination, enough altitude that lightning likes to strike you, and no real good local grounding, high conductivity of soil, so to speak. That'd be a 2 Alpha Kilo Echo, K2RIW. Go ahead, George.
Yeah, K2RIW. To be 2AKE. The soil in that area varies. I have seen traces of copper, and it does vary. There is a lot of granite, of course, but Greece has a lot of marble. But there is some copper in the ground, so it does assist to a certain degree. But the lightning is quite crazy. I videotaped it one time, and it was all over the place and very unpredictable. So regardless of what you have, you must create the best path as possible for that lightning to go. In the matter of the grounding, optimally they say if you have a 10-foot diameter round copper plate that you bury about 3 feet underground is the optimal grounding for dissipation. Back to you.
Wow. Give me a rough guess. A 10-foot diameter copper plate. I think we're talking about quite a few dollars for the investment of that particular device. Is that true, George? Go ahead.
Not very much so. That's why it's not practical. And that's why we have the rods. Either you use the all copper rods or the copper clad rods, and you definitely want to go to 10 feet. You don't want to chop them off like a lot of people do. And in the stone environment, it's even more difficult.
You brought up a very good point. Granite is very low in conductivity. Marble is very low in conductivity. Even though you may have little streaks of copper through it, it's nowhere near like ordinary Long Island soil is. Most places on Long Island, your soil has moderately good conductivity. So one or two ground rods does a fairly good job. But you get a hold of the Polyphaser book on lightning. Polyphaser is the name of a company, I think, in Nevada that sells lightning protection devices. And I'm not sure if the book is still $20, but they had a beautiful book for $20. It tells you an awful lot of things you want to know about lightning. So if you get a hold of that book, somewhere in my library, I do have a copy of it. It gives you a lot of information. So at lightning, we built up a lot of history as to what works and what doesn't work in commercial and private installations for lightning protection. Pretty wicked stuff. And lightning comes in at least 2 different flavors. Let me drop. The majority of lightning storms, the bottom of the cloud is negatively polarized. And those are the moderately big lightning bolts. Every so often, Mother Nature does things backwards, and the bottom of the cloud is positively charged. And those particular lightning bolts, oh boy, they're the ones that are 10 times louder, 10 times higher in current. Your typical lightning bolt is 11 to 12,000 amperes for 20 microseconds. For the first strike, there's usually 2, 3, or 4 strikes in very rapid succession that your eye might not even catch. But some of those are positive charge lightning storms that happen once in a while. You can get 100,000 ampere lightning bolts, and can they do damage? Wow. Thank goodness they're rare. Okay. The majority of amateur radio operators, you've got roughly 700,000 amateur radio operators in the United States. If you polled every one of them, I think you're going to find that one ham per 1,000 has occasionally had some kind of a lightning problem, and the majority of the time that lightning was through the 110-volt powering, not necessarily the lightning striking your antenna directly. Let me drop. Good common sense would lead you to believe that hey, you live in an environment where you've got ordinary houses and trees and whatever, and you put this shiny new piece of metal up in the air called your antenna. And mentally you think to yourself, boy, is this going to be a tractor of lightning? And boy, it's going to hit me first. It's very easy to think that. With rare exception, that doesn't happen. Even though it's a brand new installation on your facility, you think that you're going to be the big attractor. You're an extremely small target compared to the local power grid system. A slight exception to that is that my grandfather lived on a farm in, all of a sudden I'm troubling the name of the town, on the north shore of Long Island. It'll come to me in a minute. And on top of the hill where his farm was, it got struck with lightning an awful lot of times. However, in those days, they didn't know enough about lightning protection and putting lightning protectors on the property. Okay, so you give it a good hard try, but nothing's going to be perfect. that's what you find out when you read the books on this particular subject. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. As usual, Dick, lightning protection is an adventure. It really is. And you can do it all right, and you can still have a problem. But I agree with you. I think most of our troubles come through the Edison lines. Utility lines are notorious for that. And very few hands actually, if they do things right, get hit where there's any severe damage. But good info. All right, back to you, and let's go to Paul and see what's happening with the space report. KC2WGB.
Yeah, the name of that town was Port Washington. The northern tip of Port Washington. There's something about the local lay of the land that that particular farm my grandfather had in Port Washington. Almost every single lightning storm, a lightning would strike one of his barns or one of his buildings. And as such, my grandmother developed an extreme fear of lightning, and she would hide in the closet on every single thunderstorm. And for pretty good reason. A number of fires happened on the number of their barns from being struck. And in those days, they weren't smart enough. This was early 1920 time frame, 20s and 30s. Lightning protection techniques had not become popular in those days. Let's see. You live on the side of a pretty big hill. The biggest hill in Staten Island where you live is Toad Hill, and you live on the side of Toad Hill. I think you might want to mention one or two lightning incidents that you've encountered, John, because I think some of them are pretty good. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Oh, absolutely, Dick. Well, we're the highest point on the eastern seaboard, so 411 feet, I think it is. Yeah, we have a radio tower on the very top of that hill that gets hit fairly regularly. Originally it belonged to the diocese. I don't know who has it now. There's a couple of towers up there. But in a good thunderstorm, if I just look in that direction, I will see a hit. It's like the Empire State Building. It gets whacked here and there. But I've been hit myself. A few years ago I got hit. But just a couple of months ago I got hit on my VLF wire, which was about 70 feet long. And that was a number 12 wire. 12, and it vaporized most of it. So when it does hit, luckily I didn't lose any equipment, no damage, but it's the way I had the insulators wired that provided the protection. But that was an interesting hit, and I was in the yard when it happened. It was a big surprise, Dick. Back to you.
John, give me a couple more words on this. That piece of 12-gauge wire that became vaporized, was it horizontal, parallel to the ground? Was it vertical? Roughly how many feet above the ground? How many feet long? I think you're saying the insulators you had on it somehow protected, absorbed the arc, I'm guessing. And very nice that possibly the antenna was connected to your radio equipment, and your radio equipment suffered no damage. You live a charmed life, John. Give us a few more words on this one. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Yeah, Dick, it was connected to my VLF receiver. The ground switch was on in the shack, so that may have prevented a lot of it. But what I have is This wire was about 70 feet long, and it was up about 20 feet, 25 feet. And the porcelain egg insulators, what I had on that was there was a ground connection on one side. The wire was wound on the other side. But in between there, I had placed a soldered end that was brazed, actually, from the antenna line to the ground line directly. And then I snipped it with a pair of dikes and left a very small gap between them. And then I coated it with some PVC, not paint, let's see, varnish. It was varnish. And when I was done with the varnish, everything was set up, I just filed the tips so they would be devoid of any protection at all. So, and that was on both ends of the wire. They were discolored, so I know an arc happened, and I think that's what prevented the wire from passing it on into the shack.
Very well done, John. Very well anticipated. Make me a rough guess. That spark gap that you made with the sharp tips where you took away the varnish, roughly how big was that gap? Eighth inch, quarter inch, half inch? Make a rough guess. Over to you, John.
About a millimeter, Dick.
Wow. Okay. You're getting relatively close to the point where you're adding extra capacitance, although it was a VLF antenna. Does that mean you were listening to signals in the vicinity of 50 or 100 kilohertz, John? Go ahead.
Yes, I was, Dick, mainly below 50 kilohertz. It goes extremely low. The receiver will go to 0.01 hertz. The other one starts at around maybe 10 hertz.
Boy, this is a funny world. See, people think that I'm a big 2-meter operator. I'm not. 432, yes. 10 gigs, yes. Most of my real ham radio in the past, I'm a microwaver. And I talk to those other microwave people, WA1MBA.com. You go to www.WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha.com. Might be .org, but I think it's .com. That's the microwave website of Dr. Tom Williams. And so being a microwave operator, those guys will say anything below 1 gigahertz is DC. To them, 432 and 2 meters, that's their first and second IF. Those are not frequencies, those are IF. As you can see, the thinking of those people is that no frequency is high enough. And when I talk to you, John, and you're using numbers like 50 kilohertz and 10 hertz, and you're calling it radio, of course it is. Boy, there's a lot of octaves between there and the true microwave people. Dr. Tom Williams just reestablished the distance record last week on 78 gigahertz, 78,000 megahertz. He just extended the distance record. I don't know the exact numbers. I think the old distance record used to be 21 miles, and he held it. Now the new distance record on 78,000 megahertz, 78 gigahertz, is something like 80 miles, 81 miles, and he did it last week. He's getting lots of congratulations. There's lots of different kinds of ham radio. Now you know something about why there are 26 kinds of ham radio. No frequency is high enough. No frequency is too high for these people. There are people who think when you go above 1,000 megacycles, you're going to get a nosebleed.
Repeater, timeout.
The only thing that bleeds at those frequencies is your wallet.
Now, in my country, I do not have...
Now, these guys are real good on home brewing stuff. WA1 something or other, please give me your call letters again, sir.
This is KA2HT3 in the Mobile.
Dave. Okay, WA1VBH, Victor Hotel. He's right on the Massachusetts-New Hampshire border. And he's coming through beautiful on 2 meters, but you don't have your PL turned on. 146. Here we go. 136.5 hertz. He's a microwave from way back. You go to the QRZ.com and dial in the WA1 Victor Victor Hotel and take a look at the pretty pictures of his antenna, his Rhone 55 tower. And I wonder if you want to say a couple of words on that one. WA1VVH, make sure 136.5 hertz is turned on. Otherwise, you don't come through this repeater. K2LIW, I'm hearing him on the input. Go ahead. WA1VVH, I'm hearing you beautifully on the input. You're giving me an S2 signal, but nothing is coming through the repeater, I'm sorry to say. So there's not enough a PO in there to keep this repeater happy tonight for some crazy reason. HTV, I think you had some words for us. Go right ahead, sir. K2LIW. Okay, was I wrong? Was it HTV, N2EO, K2LIW? Go ahead.
It's Dr. Dave.
Shall return if gentlemen.
Okay, Dave, go right ahead. I think he'll be back in a minute. In the meantime, go ahead and say your comment, Rich, N2EO, K2LIW.
Okay, yes, that was Dr. Dave, KA2HT and a V. I know him. In fact, I've met Dr. Dave. We had a business meeting. I went to him for some treatment. And anyway, Dick, the reason I came back, and I hope I'm not monopolizing this, I went on TX Engineering. I don't think I'll be able to avoid the high cost of shipping. But they have aluminum tubing, 6061T8, 6 foot, 2 inch OD, 0.120 wall, $33, and with the shipping it's like $57. Does that sound like it would be thick enough? You know what I'm going to put up, which is not much.
From everything I know, that's a very good sounding piece of tubing. 120 thou wall thickness, which is approximately 1/8 of an inch, and 2 inch diameter tubing, that's going to be a fairly strong thing. That piece of tubing, in my opinion, would allow you to, if it was sticking out of the top of the tower, for instance, that could stick out of the top of the tower by a healthy 10 feet, and you could put some pretty good sized 2 meter Yagis on the top of that thing without getting a tubing failure. As I've said so many times, when you study the strength of materials, you find out the diameter of the tubing is a hell of a lot more influential than the wall thickness. If you were comparing, for instance, 2-inch diameter, 1/8-inch wall versus 1-inch diameter, 1/4-inch wall, when you double the wall thickness, but you half the diameter, the 2-inch diameter tubing would be a hell of a lot stronger when it comes to bend resistance and, you know, fold over ability, if you know what I mean. So I think that's going to do it very nicely. And $30-some-odd, that's the right price in my opinion. You're going to make a bit of an investment of aluminum tubing. But if you buy the right piece of tubing, it'll be with you for the rest of your life. It'll never rust. It'll do, and you treat it correctly. Aluminum is my favorite kind of antenna mast and boom construction material. But that's just me, and everybody agrees. There are guys out there that just love stainless steel or chrome alloy or galvanized steel tubing. The stuff is very strong, but very weighty. And let me drop. And you got to worry about weatherproofing. So that's what I've done. For me, it has worked. Let's see if Dr. Dave is back. KA2, Hotel Tango Victor, if you're there, sir. I think you want to make a comment. K2LIW.
This is KA2HT and V, Mobile, on a very rare evening that I'm on the radio and on the road. to the charge. It's always a pleasure to hear the same same topic. But you know, I think I had a question for you. I was looking to get an antenna, HF, for my very small lot. And have you had any experience with a multi-band J-pole antenna? And someone advertised it may fit into my lot, but I didn't expect much performance from it. It's about 35 feet. Theory covers up to 80 meters. But I don't know if I would expect too much from a 35-foot J-pole.
Yeah, it sounds like you're talking about a particular brand name. I'm not an HF person, so I have no experience with your multi-band HF J-pole, 35 feet tall. You might want to mention the brand name, see if anybody on frequency has any experience with it. One of the things you got to worry about, you got to remember, if you can put, let me pick a number, 100 watts into your antenna, you run a key down for 5 minutes. You turn up the transmitter and you walk over there and you touch it. And if everything is cold, and if you're getting a reasonable standing wave ratio out of it, you know that all of that 100 watts, because of a low standing wave ratio, you know, under 2 to 1, 98% of the power is going to the antenna. The antenna is running ice cold. Therefore, by definition, the antenna is damn close to 100% efficient. It has no choice. Conservation of energy. Now, you, of course, can mess that up. Depending on what kind of an antenna. If it's a quarter wave light, let me drop. If it's quarter wave light where it requires a lot of ground plane radials, I think J-poles do not, and you didn't put in those ground plane radials and you mounted low to the ground, and now you're putting your antenna very close to volumetric resistive material called earth, and now a lot of your valuable RF energy is being coupled into that earth, turned into heat, and keeping the earthworms warm in the wintertime. Yeah, you can force it to be inefficient in that manner. But other than that, almost any of the antennas we use are nearly 100% efficient. And if once you accept that, you've used reasonable materials. After that, is it a half-wave antenna that doesn't require a ground plane? Or if it's a quarter-wave antenna that does require a ground plane, have you put down enough ground plane radials? Or if you mount the whole thing high enough up in the air, like on the roof of the house, almost no ground plane radials are required because the whole structure is far. Just the three little rods on the bottom of a station master does a very good job because the antenna is high enough above the ground. So a heck of a lot of antennas that people think is going to be inefficient. If it passes that thermal test of 100 watts for 5 minutes, it can't be inefficient. Maybe that helps a little bit. So what's the brand name of your multi-band J-pole? Let's find out if anybody has any experience with it. Dr. Dave, KA2HTV, K2RIW.
It's called amateur antenna. Problem is the power limitation is 750 watts. I just live in a very awkward situation where I have to limit what I have. I was going to put up a vertical, but the ground radials would have to be extremely short, probably 1/10 of a wavelength, 0.15. But I guess if I put, you know, a lot, it wouldn't matter. I mean, it's like a boat in the ocean. The antenna looks at the ocean. It's not resonant, but it's pretty damn good reflection. So I should investigate that, but it'd be a lot of work. I could put as many radials, but they'd all be very short. But that meant for two.
Now, one of the unconventional antennas that has never been given proper emphasis, Dr. Dave, is the half-wave radiator. You would think a half-wave dipole has to be set in the center. Absolutely not. If you make the antenna electronically a half wave long, and you can do that in multiple bands simultaneously if you're smart enough, but if the antenna is a half wave long, and you feed it from the outer tip, now if you've got a tree nearby that's high enough that you can slope this antenna over to it, maybe you have to put a loading coil in the middle of it to make it electronically a half wave when you don't have enough physical half wave length, and then you feed it from the outer tip where you're feeding a 2,000 ohm impedance. no ground plane radios are required. You got to do a little bit of an impedance step up. You got to put a an L network in there, which is easy to design from the Berkeley program. In other words, Google the word Berkeley and impedance match. You'll get this beautiful program. You plug in the numbers, and it'll give you 16 solutions. You choose the one that you like. So impedance matching the 2,000 ohm impedance to the outer tip of a half-wave dipole, which requires no ground plane radials. One simple spike in the ground is more than enough. And why that antenna is not more popular on temporary sites like field day sites and whatever, it's just a matter of tradition. People haven't thought about that. So if the ground plane radios give you grief, that's one way of avoiding them. I wonder if you've heard about that one before, Dave. KA2HTV, K2LIW.
I have a good solution for Dave, Dick.
Dave first. Go ahead, Dave.
What would be a reasonable thing for me to do is to get a half-wave vertical center fed with 300 ohms wireless. Just, and you slope it down 45 degrees, but, you know, it's ugly. And if it's in the backyard, it's fine, but I don't have a big enough backyard. It's in front, people see it, and I have a, what you call it again, a lovely homeowners association, Incorporated Village Architecture Review Board would not be too happy with that. I'm going to turn it over to Richard, and I got to go inside because I'm approaching my house.
Yeah, hold on a minute. I don't know why you're insisting on feeding in the center with twin leads. Stop thinking that you have to feed it in the center. One simple piece of wire fed from the outer tip with no ground plane radials. And that piece of wire is half wavelength long electronically. A piece of wire can be made invisible as all hell. No homeowners association would ever even see it, Dave. K2HTV, K2LIW.
Not a bad solution, but Rich, I want to hear your solution. I got to go inside.
Got it. You got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Well, this is something they would see. Now, I don't know if they would object to it. When I lived in Whitestone, Queens, Dave, I don't know if you know, I moved out to Massapequa Park. But in Whitestone, I had a Cushcraft R8 vertical. It's an electrical half wave with very short radials, just a counterpoise. Cushcraft recommends it be 12 feet off the ground. It worked extremely well for me. Extremely well. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that antenna has a number of doodads on it, coils and whatever, and it's a fairly substantial piece of aluminum, which will show up to a homeowners association. One simple piece of wire strung to a tree, sloping, horizontal, vertical, whatever, is a hell of a lot more invisible. And that piece of wire could be, let me pick a number, 24 gauge, where without binoculars you'll never see it. And yet you can still be getting 98% radiation efficiency. So there are various ways around this one. So don't give up, Dave. Paul, I know we've interrupted you quite a few times. WS2N is going to be giving us the space report. I did hear a report this week, Paul, that NASA supposedly has made a decision to start building their own reusable space shuttle-like aircraft, launching craft, to get to the International Space Station, where they've got so many commercial businesses all working simultaneously. I'm having trouble believing that story, but that's what I heard, that NASA has made a decision this week to build their own reusable launch vehicle. WS2N, K2RIW, you got it, Paul.
This is WS2N. Well, I haven't read that. I know they're involved with DARPA, that agency in creating the XS1. For experimental spacecraft one, I think that's what it stands for. But they want to just be able to send cargo up and bring this thing back on land like a plane. I wonder if that's what you're talking about. No crew involved. It might be involved with Lynx, which is a spacecraft being built by X-Corps. They might get involved with them. They have a suborbital craft that's well under development, which would carry a crew of two people. So does anything like this sound familiar, Dick, from what you heard? Well, that's okay. We'll cover that later. I just wanted to go over, I was going to talk a little bit about the history of Voyager, but there's a couple of other things that have made it into the news recently, including amateur radio newsline. Last week they were talking about a satellite that the Chinese plan on putting into orbit around the moon, and they plan on having a transmitter for 2 meters. So of all the people that are going to be doing this first, China plans on doing it. It would be transmitted on 145.990 megahertz, but you would need that software with WJ. What is it? I know you know it, Dick. But they're gonna, you know, you're gonna use that software to detect the signals coming from this thing. The reason they're doing it is that they want to send a satellite up around the moon to test their ability to get ready for maybe a couple of years from now to send a spacecraft to the moon to dig up some soil, put it on a launcher, and launch it back to Earth. We've done it a half a dozen times with people. We've gone there, put rocks in a spaceship, and brought them back many hundreds of pounds each time. The Russians have done it. They've only brought a couple of pounds back on a rover that they had back in the 70s. And now China wants to do it as well. But to get ready for it, they need to put a satellite up there. So they're going to send this ham radio transmitter, they call it, the mode is JT65B. That's what they said on Newsline. Not sure what that's all about. I don't do that type of ham radio receiving. But we'll see how it works out. That'll be at the end of the year, probably, November or December or something like that. They're getting ready for their Chang 5 mission, which will actually be a sample return mission from the moon. I had to mention that. Let me drop it.
I'll give you a couple of words on that. And sorry, I got called away for a couple of minutes when you passed it over to me. Joe Taylor, K1JT, a Nobel laureate, has invented a whole series of these things called WSJT, Weak Signal Joe Taylor, WSJT, computer-like communication systems, called the modern-day equivalent of digital signal processing. So by various JT modes, and one of them is called JT65 Bravo, is a kind of computer program which will take a ham radio signal of a particular format that is as much as 28 decibels below the noise of your receiver, minus 28 dB signal-to-noise ratio, and will give you a fairly coherent message printed across your computer screen. So you can have rather low-power transmitters in some of these Joe Taylor techniques for transmitting signals over very long distances for moon bounce, meteor scatter, tropo, and whatever. So that's what I think we're talking about here, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, I know. You mentioned it a number of times, and I wasn't too sure if I had it right. You know, I had listened to the broadcast, and I saw you said WJSC, Whiskey Juliet Sierra Tango. Is that what you're saying there?
Yeah, Whiskey Sierra Juliet Tango stands for Weak Signal Joe Taylor. So Joe Taylor Technique number 65 Bravo is the one that you're talking about. He has a number of different modulation protocols for these very weak signal techniques. Some of them put out four separate tone frequencies in various combinations in order to give you very weak signal reception. Call it the much more modern-day equivalent of radio teletype, if you like. And some of these Joe Taylor techniques, WSJT techniques, are capable of very, very weak signal and yet very good reception. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, it sounds like I mixed up the letters, and I'm saying it was WJSC, so I probably heard WSJT. Okay, I got it. Weak signal. I have WJSC. Very good, Dick. Well, that's what, you know, the Chinese are up to. You know, they landed a lander on a moon last December, and they had a rover on it. It worked 2 weeks, and the extreme cold temperatures got to the electronics, and that was the end of that. They were hoping to run this thing for a couple of months, but that didn't work out. We'll see how they do next time. I want to talk about robotic tree from the International Space Station. They have a European Space Agency astronaut, Alex Gertz, on board, one of the six that are on board. And they tried an hour and a half experiment with him operating a rover at the European Space Agency in Europe. And they have this big rover, I mean, full-size rover, about the size of a Spirit, you know. And he operated this thing, drove it around just by himself, cameras, onboard cameras, telemetry that was being radioed up from the rover. And they want to see how this works, because eventually they'll have astronauts in orbit around the moon, around Mars. They want to know, you know, the capabilities, how it's going to work out, operating rovers down on a moon or Mars, or maybe a moon of Mars, and operating from a spacecraft orbiting a planet. Make a long story short, that was a very good success, he's the second guy to do that. They had another astronaut, Sylvie Wynne Williams, to do that a couple of few years ago for a very short period of time, but this is more of an advanced test. So talk about opportunity. That thing is now over 10 years old, riding around on Mars. I saw pictures of it recently. It takes once in a while to take a picture of itself. I guess a selfie. And you look at the panel, it's cleaner now than they've ever been before. You know, from the first day that they landed. Once in a while, they get a little dust devil storm going by, a little wind, and it blows all the dust off the panels. They're good to go, and they bring them back up to you know, their 100. 200 watts, whatever it is, capability. And I think it's still going. Spirit is dead in the water since 2010 in March. And, but Opportunity is still driving around after over 10 years, over 25 miles. It's got the record for off-road planetary driving. So I had to talk about Opportunity. I know we talk about Curiosity all the time, and eventually Curiosity has got to joined by another Curiosity, similar type of rover, 2020. But Opportunity is still up there doing science, and good credit to the people that put that thing together. Now that's the good news. The bad news for the you might say bad news anyway, for SpaceX anyway. Friday night, they had their test vehicle. They have a Falcon 9R. Augment for reusable. This is a test vehicle that they've been flying a couple times in McGregor, Texas, where they have a testing facility. The last test that they had was, I don't know, about a month or two ago, and it went up to about 3,000 feet. They were going to try to do something similar to that, or maybe a little higher. And it went up. Something went wrong inside the booster, and it went into some kind of self-destruct and blew up. Quite a plastic, but some people go out there and they know a flight's going to be taking them off, and they'll go watch it. And flights never go up more than a couple thousand feet. And then they come back down and land. They did it many, many times. It's a grasshopper version, a smaller version. And recently they just started to do this with the full version of the Falcon 9. Well, they call it the Falcon 9. It's really got three engines that they're using do this launch, fly around for a bit, come back and land in the same place that they took off from. Well, see how that works in the future, because they have plans on eventually going to New Mexico. Spaceport America is a big facility that's been opened up to private industry to test their rockets. Where you can take a rocket like the Falcon 9R and launch it up to near space, probably if you want 400,000 feet and bring it back down. That was the next move. As they get to this test or the test after that, they're probably going to ship everything to Spaceport America. Well, who knows? I know you guys think you wanted to talk about this shuttle-like thing that NASA's coming up with. Not sure if we're talking about the same thing. What are you talking about? The XS1, X-ray Sierra 1 reusable unmanned rocket that will put 4,000 pounds in space, maybe an average of once a day, so like 10 days in a row before that's being refurbished. Or are we talking about something else?
Yeah, I was at a celebration this afternoon. I got this message from one of the people attending this party told me that NASA is coming up with their own launch vehicle. We didn't get into the details as to whether or not it was manned or unmanned. So if this cargo ship that you're talking about, probably that's what he was talking about. And maybe there was some form of announcement in the last week or so that he was bringing to my attention. So I think you're saying NASA is pursuing a unmanned cargo launch vehicle, and that's XS-1, X-ray Sierra-1. Sounds like it's fulfilling that one, and maybe that's the confusion. I jumped to the conclusion that it was a manned vehicle, and I guess it doesn't have to be, because we now have a number of alternate techniques of sending men up to the International Space Station. Cargo is the main thing, because maintaining a human being in space requires a continuous supply of consumables. Those human beings are chewing up oxygen, water, food, and air pressure has to be maintained, water has to be maintained, food's got to be maintained, energy for heat and light and running all the equipment, lots and lots of stuff has to be continuously supplied. The solar cells can give you power, but there's a lot of material things that have to be continuously supplied. As I've said often, you think about what's required to keep you alive on planet Earth. Let me drop this. The amount of air that you breathe, the amount of water and food you consume, packed as tight as you can, would fill up the volume of your house in 1 year. And it has the mass approximately of your house. One house full of stuff with the weight of your house is supplied to your body every year to keep you alive. We take that for granted. And good old Earth is recycling all those materials. Well, in space, you don't have anywhere near the convenience of that recycling. Somebody's got to continuously supplying a cargo ship to keep all that going, as well as some boosting action. Over to you, Paul, for the US2N, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. I know they're trying, like heck to recycle the water and different things they have on board the space station. Do that for every pound that they can recycle, they don't have to bring up. It's so expensive, and that's why they're looking for these new ways to bring people and cargo to the space station at an inexpensive cost. And the XS-1 project, been on a drawing board by DARPA for, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 years. DARPA is that agency, Defense Advanced Research Project Group. That they're the ones that they'll fund the these races in the middle of the desert. You know, we've talked about that, I think, before. They'll take robots, different universities and groups will put them together, and they'll have to drive them across the desert. And if you make it to the other end, you know, you'll get $1 million or something. But this agency is, they're always way out in front. And they've been pushing the XF-1 project. And now NASA's been signing up with them. And they'll look for probably people to do it. There's one guy that I know they're interested in, that might get involved. Who knows? He's got hardware ready to go. In a couple of years, he's going to be putting our Taurus up in space called the Lynx by X-Tor. The Lynx is a spacecraft, liquid fueled, liquid oxygen, that will put one person up in space. Similar to what Virgin Galactic was doing with Branson. He's got a bigger one, Spaceship 2, they call it, and he's going to be putting up 6 people at a time. But at $200,000, I think it's big money. This guy, I think, is going to do it for $90,000 or something, $90,000 a ticket. But just you and a pilot, you know, you get a space suit. Next to the sky and off you go in the Lynx, and they plan on having this thing be able to launch 3 or 4 times a day. So they're well into this type of thing. They need really a suborbital type of rocket. That's what NASA's looking for with the XS-1. You know, they'll blast it up like, you know, Fox 10 or something, and then out of the back they'll send the satellite with a booster on it, and then that will send maybe 3,000 or 4,000 pounds to orbit. That's the goal of that. But I take the Lynx project, you know, you can send cargo up with, just redevelop this thing a little bit differently. Maybe they can use that, or maybe they'll do something completely different. I know Northrop Grumman is involved, going to be involved with this. Maybe they'll put it together, I don't know. So that's one way of reestablishing the ability to put cargo to the space station. You know, they have private companies now, but they want to do it even cheaper. You can do it with these type of flights. The XS-1. A lot less expensive with SpaceX or with Orbital Science. Next has the Dragon spacecraft, which brings up cargo to the space station. Orbital Science has the Cygnus spacecraft, bringing up cargo to the space station. Dragon comes back with, you know, it'll land on in the water, eventually on land, to bring supplies back. And Cygnus doesn't, burns up over the Pacific Ocean, similar to Progress. But you need other, you know, you're going to need more and more of this as time goes on. You need redundancy. One company goes down, SpaceX could be a trouble now. with an explosion on the test version of the Falcon 9. They have a launch coming up this Tuesday. Drop it. WS2N. WS2N, they have a launch from Florida. Space complex number 40 that they own. And they'll be putting up a satellite to geosynchronous orbit for Asia. You know, they private launch has nothing to do with NASA, nothing to do with the United States. It's the deal that they're getting paid for to put the satellite up. Now, is that going to compromise this launch, this problem? I don't know. You know, they've had a lot of success in launches, one right after the other, probably about 10 or 11 launches. Their first major failure. But you got to remember, eventually, the Falcon 9, the Dragon, is not going to be only bringing up cargo, it's going to be bringing up people. These have to be reliable. And that's why they should go with all three companies, SpaceX, Orbital Science, Cargo, drop it. And Sierra Nevada with the shuttle-like spacecraft, which will carry up to 7 astronauts and also cargo to the space station. This is being developed and supported and paid for some, you know, by taxpayers. We're helping build these things. And even Boeing plans on bringing up crews to the space station, maybe up to 7 people with the CST 100. I think they should go with all of these, including Lynx now. Let's bring them on. The Lynx spacecraft by X-Corp. Bring them all on board, and then you'll never have a problem like you got now with the Russian Soyuz spacecraft. The reliability on them, $70 million an astronaut, gets kind of costly. Back to you, Dick. WS2M for the Space Report.
Leo, Dick, I have a question.
Go ahead with your question, Rich.
Okay, Dick, I'll address it to you and you can address it to Paul. I guess this is what you call a directed net, although we're kind of loose about it. How likely is it, in your opinion, Dick, or Paul's opinion, that we might get a geosynchronous ham radio satellite? Barry was telling me that there's one now over Europe, but it does not cover, the footprint doesn't cover the United States. What's nice about a geo, unlike these microsats, you don't have to track them. You put up an antenna and lock it down. Back to you, Dick.
I don't think that the United States hams have launched a geosynchronous satellite yet. I know that some of the satellites have had a highly elliptical orbit that got as high as the GEO, but they didn't dwell there, and they came back down to a much lower altitude on the other backside of the orbit, so to speak, and that orbit slowly precessed. So I haven't been keeping track of this one, Paul, following through with what I think is Rich's question, has Europe or Japan launched or are about to launch any amateur radio satellite that is truly synchronous? And the word synchronous, there's various variations of that. In other words, absolutely geosynchronous orbit is exactly over the equator. It's something very, very close to 22,300 miles up in a very circular orbit. And most of the geosats that are out there right now, LEOs, GEOs, MEOs, the geosats, have some form of station-keeping thrusters on board. Because even though you put it in the right place with the right orbit, it doesn't want to stay there. Mother Nature is continuously disturbing things with solar wind and moon interaction and so on, and mass concentrations on the Earth. All kinds of things happen. And each of the GEO satellites have an assigned address. Let me drop. It's a one-dimensional assigned address, nothing but a longitude. Because if you're really geosynchronous, there is no latitude, you're directly over the equator. There is no ellipticity of orbit in theory.